Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Edge of Futurist podcast. This is a very special version of the podcast because we are actually live at the Haberdasheries Trust, Multi Academy Trust conference down in the south. So us northerners with our northern accents, we're allowed down into this place. We had to pay a charge to come in though, didn't we, Steve, actually?
We did, yeah. Past Sheffield, apparently, they don't want us any further.
That's so. The south, yeah. So they give a tax on northerners to come. Or does everybody have to pay that tax? I don't know. So we're doing a live podcast in as part of the conference day, and we're really glad to be joined by four special guests who are going to share their perspectives on the future of education. And so we're going to ask them to introduce themselves, and then we'll talk a little bit around what we've got some questions around the themes from the conference. So first of all, if I could ask Emily, you want to introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about you.
Okay, so my name is Emily Juma, and I have the pleasure of being the head teacher at Haberdashers Hatcham Primary based in New Cross. So you can't see me, but I've been a teacher since 2002. It's hard to believe, but yes. So I've been in education, working in education since 2002, and I became the head teacher in 2015.
Brilliant. So you've been part of the Haberdashers family for...
No. So I started as an NQT in 2002. I became part of the Haberdashers family in 2008, and wow. I'm still here.
Wow. Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Next up, we've got Simon.
Hi there. Yeah, my name's Simon Locke. I'm one of the governors, so I'm deputy chair of the trust, and I'm also chair of governors at Knights Academy, which is a role I'm very proud of, one of our secondary schools, and a governor at Knights Primary. Which is one of our primary schools. I'm a businessman by background, so I'm here to learn as much as anything, but my parents were teachers, and I've always had a lifelong respect for teachers and education.
Perfect, thank you.
Next up we have Steve.
Hi, my name's Steve Payne. I'm the Head of Data, Insight and Analysis at Haberdashers Primary Trust. I joined the trust in 2017 as a data manager at one of our schools, but I took on the new position as head of data September last year, so I've been in position for just over about a year and a half now. Before that, I did 10 years in prison. I worked in Young Offenders Institute. I worked there. I was there for a lot longer than some of the clients we were working with, actually. So it was a very interesting environment, but it was all around educational data, but it's nice to be in a more mainstream setting.
What was I thinking?
We've just had for those people, obviously, we're just a podcast today. We normally go video. Just had a guest walk in, which is, do you want to just introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Vanessa Hiller, and I come from a background of teaching in primary schools. First as a TA in a primary school, that was for 4.5 years. Did my teacher training course, started teaching in primary schools, been in education in that direction for about 20 years. Did a sculpture degree originally, but decided actually I have an absolute love for reading, that was what I wanted to do. Started working at the secondary school here, and that was as a phonics and reading intervention teacher. Been in the role of Deputy Senko for about 2 months now, and I'm absolutely loving it.
Absolutely wonderful. And last but not least, we have Jacob.
Thanks. I always ask myself, how should I introduce myself? Where do I start? So my name is Jacob. I am by admission an avid, big supporter of youth work. So I'm a youth worker. I am also a former young mayor of Lewisham. So in Lewisham, we have a directly elected young mayor. We also have a directly elected young mayor. I am also a board member at the Youth Justice Board, so it's interesting to see that someone on the panel has some connection to youth justice. The Youth Justice Board is an omnibus body, part of the Ministry of Justice, and we're responsible for disseminating the money from government to all of our youth justice services in England and Wales. I'm a dad. So that's something I'm extremely proud of, and it really does shape my experiences and how I show up in spaces such as this.
Definitely does. I'm a dad of two very young children. I love my children, but they're very feral.
How's that to survive?
My kids just don't stop running. Do you know the advert when you see, is it Duracell? We're not sponsored by Duracell, but the batteries exist.
Unless they want to.
Yeah,
they
want to. That's absolutely fantastic. But my children are two, and 3.5, and it has completely changed my perspective. And I think I've been involved in education for 17 years. I now sit as and lead in a global ed tech company as well as the Edufuturist. But my focus on really why I want to continue the work around Edufuturist is the preparation for education for when they are in education in a few years' time. My daughter had to get a uniform for the first time. It's an interesting concept of how I feel about uniforms, but I've stepped over that because it was a pretty picture. So let's really get delved in. The title that we were given for the day was Together Stronger Culture and Community for the professional development. So I think that the whole first delve into the theme of, okay, so if education institutions have to foster a strong sense of community and belonging, how can they do that and do it strongly for people with diverse and cultural backgrounds? And I suppose, should we start, I'm going to throw it out, and I'm going to start with Steve, if that's all right.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a big topic, isn't it? And I think sometimes it helps to, the way I approach it anyway, is to try and break these things down a bit. So when we talk about community, what are we talking about in terms of community? Are we talking about sort of diverse area where diversity is celebrated and where people are encouraged to have their differences? Or we talk about community where people from different communities all share a common purpose and a common approach? I guess that's kind of the academic approach, and you've got the differences between what you would call maybe, like, I'm driving back to school now, you've got your bonding capital and your bridging capital. So are you talking about bridging some of these diverse communities together so they've all got a common purpose and a common goal, and we're trying to push them all together as one unit? Or are we trying to recognise all the differences within our schools and help them thrive it's a tough old question. I'm sorry, I haven't given you a very coherent answer.
No.
I think you have to start there, and then you have to actually say, what does diversity mean? And certainly a lot of what I do in my role is looking at how we measure the diversity within our schools, for example. And I mean, that goes much more beyond, I mean, 10 years ago and even 5 years ago, people were talking about different ethnic groups, and they were talking about maybe children with SEN versus children who haven't got SEN. Now we're looking much further than that. You know, you look, ethnic groups can be broken down by sub-nationalities within them. You can look at people from different parts of the same country. You know, somebody who's white British who's from perhaps Liverpool may have a very different social profile to someone from Surrey, for example. And even within those areas, you've got, you know, there's geography plays a role. It's a huge topic. A huge topic.
For sure. And obviously the conversation around belonging and be part of that. Obviously, from a governmental perspective, there's been a positioning around British values and about how important that is, what the right and wrongs of that are, and whether it's possible to do that. And then also, how do we celebrate diversity within that mix? Because ultimately, do we want to make everybody follow British values? I think there's very much an argument around that. I don't know if we'll get there in that conversation. But it's that conversation about how do we foster community and belonging. I think that's how are we together stronger. I don't know if anybody wants to speak into that from a perspective of how important it is we get that together stronger from diverse cultural backgrounds.
I think representation matters a lot. But representation not in the way that you might see it represented. And what I mean by that is I'm dual heritage. My father's African, comes from Ghana. My mum is white. She grew up in Shropshire. I grew up in Moorside in Manchester. If you looked at me as a whole, you would go, I'm going to culturally give this girl something on the curriculum that's going to work for her. But would it work for me if I've been brought up by a white mother who fed me egg and chips? You know, actually, we can't make presumptions.
Sure.
I still volunteer at the Migration Museum, which is in Lewisham. They've done an amazing job at collaborating with the community on a shared sense of stories. So they actually have an archive where they collect all of the data, all of the stories, and they have it recorded. So you would get stories from the Irish community, you would get them from the Eastern European community. And what they do really, really well is they do educational workshops for children. And those workshops involve talking about refugees and the idea of migration. The other thing I would say is, apart from doing this job, I'm an artist. I paint I also do sewing pieces, but I have a studio in Woolwich. And I've been included in some absolutely amazing exhibitions, playing the race card, which was having black voices heard, their paintings seen in Hastings. I was also part of, there's a company called Black Minds Matter, and they're on Instagram. They also have a website. They're specifically looking at mental health in black people and people of colour. And the reason they're doing that is because they recognise that everybody's voice is important, and that sometimes, as a black person, if you have a white therapist, they might not understand the issues that you face with racism. Mm. And so I think, as a school, if we're going to actually connect and do this community thing, we need to have the voices of parents heard, and we need to do that small talk where we listen to stories and we get a sense of where everybody's coming from in order to connect them. Because when you hear your own story heard, it's incredibly life-changing.
So I wanted, in regards to being diverse and just, first of all, there's, you've got some, I think this goes back a bit, because I think some people do in a tokenistic way, and you'll see that they'll change the curriculum or the books that they use. Like you said, our children need to be seen in the books, in the text, in different things that we use, that they're represented and that their voice is seen. So for me, it's about getting to know your community, because yes, you are a school, but you have to know what's around your community. What are the things that our children are experiencing? So, you know, there's two primary schools in New Cross, and we're both in the same trust. Even though we're in New Cross, it's completely different. One of the primary schools, in comparison, if you look at the community in comparison to the community where my primary school is, you'd think, but you're both in New Cross, but it's completely different. And it's about knowing, so what works for my primary school won't necessarily work for the other primary school, which is in New Cross, because the community is different. However, it doesn't mean that they shouldn't explore it. They should know about what's going on within their community, because it's still based in, we're still in New Cross. So I think it starts from the beginning, and also it starts with the staff as well, understanding. Because I have had members of staff feel that when they've had to speak to some of the parents, oh, they're just so aggressive. Actually, they're not aggressive. Believe it or not, that's just how they talk. That's their culture. They're not shouting at you. That's just how they talk. But, you know, they feel... But, again, it's being able to talk to somebody to be able to understand, and actually just taking that time to talk with our families, with our parents and our children. And I just think it just starts from... With me, it just starts with knowing my community, knowing the children, and then the families, and knowing that they can also be heard. So, again, and it's about sharing your experience as well. And like Steve said about breaking down the data, For me, I just find it so, like, when we have to break it down to black, Caribbean, black African, I just feel like at the end of the day, they're all children. Does it matter what their ethnicity is? They all just should still have that exact same level playing field. That's how.
It's a real challenge. And I think to kind of go across both of those opinions, trying to push out a national agenda or a national agreement. This is the challenge, I suppose, for the DfE in education, where it's a case of they're pushing and saying, across all of England, this is what we believe. But the problem is there any autonomy there, like you've said, at local level, to really understand what community means individually for each organisation, whether that could be, because you might be a primary school that has no single... Yeah. governing body that actually might be across a whole group. So actually your community in terms of that stakeholder might be very different to another, and also the demographic of types of students that are coming in, the parents, is a more, actually when you say the word parent, for a lot of primary schools, I was a chair of governors, that word parent is very different, because it might be not from, it might be from individual parents, it might be from a lot of looked after children, lots of different variations, and if you can't apply individual context to really what community and an understanding of that is, we real face challenge. And I think one of the challenges that we kind of push against is, if you push something out and say it is a must do, like with data, and you have to cut your data this way, it really doesn't allow the flexibility and the autonomy for heads and schools to really start to think about it.
And I think the question there was about belonging as well as community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's a big thing there around what belonging really means. So you can belong without believing the same. So it's that idea of togetherness, and we don't have to have the same beliefs, values. Well, I suppose actually, no, that's that, interestingly, I say we don't need to have the same beliefs and values. We don't have to have the same beliefs, but do we need to value the same thing? Is that part of it? Is that important about in terms of belonging, building that culture of belonging, which is the as a former sociology and religious studies teacher, the idea around culture is about a shared set of norms and values. So what are we sharing as values, whether that is values around togetherness, identity, story, the broader community that we're part of, that kind of comes to it. And interestingly, to move us into that next question really is around how we can use education to leverage the strengths and perspectives of these individual communities to prepare students for this global world, more connected than ever before. And so how do we use education to leverage the strengths and perspectives of those individual communities to prepare students for that space? Sam?
Yeah, I come at it partly as a businessman, so I'm looking a little bit from the outside, but one of the keys seems to me particularly to get parents to be more involved in the governance of their schools. And so one of the struggles in this trust is, and I get this from the head teachers, this is not my own view, but the head teacher of the school where I'm involved says their parents, the parents care passionately about the behaviour of their own individual child, but it's more difficult to get them to represent their group, even though their voice would really be listened to. So at our school now, we're about to launch a real attempt to increase the level of parental engagement so we could understand these individual stories. That, I mean, I think it was so interesting to hear the stories we've already heard, that, and people don't just get, the biggest group in the school I'm involved is Black African. Mm. What does that mean? I mean, that involves such a wide range of cultures.
Yeah.
It's really not, it's not a terribly helpful description. So we need to get, I think, far, you know, that would be
absolutely
something I would like to see, much more parental engagement
you
in
the
school.
You can't pick it up on the data. You can't. The data I read, I was reading one report about autism and Black boys and Black girls. None of it actually married up with being able to look at data, because most of the data that's been done, the research on children, like the connection between free school meals children and SEN children, it all doesn't match up. You would have to look at every facet, like you do with intersectionalism, where if you just look at feminism, you go, we've moved quite far in feminism, but if you look at Black feminism, are you bringing it into that other feminism?
Lots of isms.
The parental thing, I also feel absolutely passionately about, but what I want to ask sometimes is, do parents feel intimidated to come into school? My mum was very, very, we were below the poverty line. There were times we didn't have food in our house. My mum had 3 cleaning jobs. She would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, go to work, come home miraculously, and we would have breakfast, I would go to school. She would go to her other job whilst I was at school, I would come home, she would be home for an hour, then she would go out to her other job. I don't know when the woman slept, but she was too intimidated to come to school because she felt the school was already judging her. Mm. And actually what I would have needed from the school is for someone to pick up a phone, not just put an event on, not just send an email, call her and say, actually, I just want you to know that this is the situation right now with your child, but I'm actually working with you. So the issues that I've had in the past and fairly previously is there's been a miscommunication between me and a parent. So it might have been that the miscommunication is that I'm just ringing someone up to have a go about the fact that their child has done something. I've learnt that some of the first words I can say to someone is, hi, how are you? I just want to say that. I've noticed that I haven't got to speak to you for a while, but I want you to know that I'm here to support you and I'd love your support back with your child. And then we'll go into the conversation. And I think we all do that when we try and talk to parents.
Sure.
But it's how do you then make that into a further reaching thing? So, for instance, do you set up different groups and then do you bring them all together?
Mm.
So at the moment, I know that I've been told in other schools in to do with the trust that they have set up really good little groups for students who are autistic, their parents, especially over things like school refusal. It's we have to be really direct sometimes. Mm. We have to go, instead of looking at this as this big, I want a community collection of people coming in because it's cultural day, what are we doing on a day-to-day basis to bring parents in? What are we doing?
And I think the important thing there sits with something that Emily mentioned earlier. It's about the tokenism and a lot of the things around community and belonging and cohesion and justice. They become tokenistic because we all feel like we'll do a cultural day or we'll do a mental health well-being day, and it's like, well, if we've not got that culturally embedded as a principle and a value, then we're messing up. Jacob, is there anything you would speak to this?
I think it's been really interesting to listen, because I think all other panelists, you guys have a direct connection in terms of the federation and what your roles look like. I think my perspective of being in the community and just thinking myself as someone who went to a haberdasher school and the part that I play, I feel like when we talk about education, there's always two sides to it. We tend to look at the formal side, it makes sense, it's all about data, but we don't look at the informal side. Mm-hmm. And that's where the community part comes in. There's an education on both sides. I think we have to remember, when we're talking about families, we're talking about adults who've been traumatized as young people through the education system, dealing with the education system now as a parent. So before you can even engage them as a parent, you have to consider what has been their lived experience when they were in education. Most of us escaped it, and it felt like it was an escape. So now having to go back in and advocate for your young person, you're always entering that, or sometimes often entering that space in a defensive mode rather than what can the school do for me and my young person. Just thinking about what Emily mentioned earlier around two schools in the same area, having completely different groups of young people that go there. I've actually, my son's three, he's going to be going into nursery and or reception, whatever it is. I can't remember, but I know he's going into formal education. And for me, my mind is always, okay, where do we send him? His mom is very specific. She knows the dates, the times, everything. Yeah. For me, I'm like, okay, what is the atmosphere? And one space I went into, they were really big on speaking a certain language. And the other school was really more around what's best for the young person and the atmosphere for them. And I thought to myself, when you think about Britain and you talk about British values, we don't like to talk about it because it either makes us uncomfortable or some people are very clear on what that means for them. I come from the States. I moved here when I was 11 years old. And even though I see myself as British, there's always that double consciousness in my brain in terms of how I experience things. And I notice in this country, we don't like talking about class, but that is a very big thing that affects a lot of our young people. Mm-hmm. So if you're, whether you're the offensive young parent or you're someone who's very much, you know, open to being supported in a school, immediately how you show up in that space has a lot to do with your professional background and whether you see yourself having privilege. So going into that school ready for an argument might be your way of approaching defending my young person. And another parent might come in saying, you know, I've taken the time to read the policies on the website, so I know exactly what the procedures are, and I just want to give you a chance to express yourself before I can tell you where you went wrong. Either way, you still got both defensive parents, but they're coming at it from different angles. I think for me, in terms of how we center this conversation around community cohesion, all of these words are extremely ambiguous. And if you're talking about words, you have to ask yourself, do we have the same definition? Mm. And quite often, we don't have conversations where we ask, are you saying something, and what words are you using? Is it the same of what I think it is? Mm. So when a parent comes in or someone, a professional is speaking, you know, they might think they're using all the right words. So when we talk about race and culture and diversity, what are we being diverse about? Because arguably, if we look at the statistics, we know that white working class boys are underachieving in the same way black Caribbean boys are. Mm-hmm. You know, but what is the difference in terms of their attainment and accessibility to be able to be self-sustaining in a society? So yes, they're big topics, but I think one thing I enjoy about my American side, and it's not perfect if you ever watch the news, but in America, they have this possibility that the American dream, this idea that I can change things no matter how big it is. And in this country, we're very much stuck into, well, this is the way how things are. And the do is do. And because the do is do, they're so busy doing, they don't get the chance to sit around a table and talk about, you know, what's the theory of it all.
And that's where I feel it comes down to the school, the people who are leading the school, because I very much believe in. I always tell my children about my own. I grew up, again, my parents were working class. I was born in Ghana, but we came, myself and my three brothers and my dad and my mum, we emigrated to London. My dad and my mum both came from very extremely successful jobs back home in Ghana, but obviously when they came here, you know, my mum was, she started off as a dinner lady, my dad started off driving the cab, taxi driver, all of that. But anyway, we grew up in the council estate, the same as Rio Ferdinand. I always drop that in because you know. It's again, it's just like, so who would have thought, you know, a girl that grew up on the council estate is now a head teacher of a primary school. And that's something that I always share with my children. Regardless, it doesn't matter, there are opportunities. And I think it comes down to the person who is either leading that school or who, you know, your team around you. And again, it's the conversations that you have with the parents. Like you say, you've got some parents who will come straight on the defensive side, and you have to be ready for that. And as a person or who's leading that school, your community, you need to be aware of your different families. You need to know, when we call this family in, we need to be prepared. You know, I won't name, but I can think of parents straight away. When I know I'm calling that parent, it's going to be an argument. Mm-hmm. So this is how I'm going to do it. Whereas, you know, when I call this parent, I know they will take things on board. So it's about knowing your community. And there is no right way, but it's down to you as a leader, how I see it. If you really want to drive that diverse, celebrating individual, celebrate, because celebrating an individual and being diverse is not just about your race, it's about everything. Yeah. Now you have to consider, you know, families having, you know, two mums or two dads or being brought up by their grandparents, you know, people's sexuality. So, you know, being diverse is very, it's not as simple as, you know, mixed heritage where people used to think, oh, it was just black and white. It's not actually, you know, my friend, you know, she says, I'm Italian, I've got Irish in me, I've got Nigerian. I was like, all right, stop, calm down. But so, you know, it's just being able to, it's just about you as a person. How are you going to make sure everyone, it's not easy, but everyone is seen and everyone is accepted. And it's just celebrating that you're an individual. You know, I've got, you know, I'm dyslexic. It's okay, kids, it's fine. It's not, don't be ashamed about it. That's my thing. It's, if you want them to feel they are accepted or it's okay, it's about knowing your children, knowing your family and knowing your community.
Agreed. Really, really.
I think, just to try and pull some points together, I think data sometimes gets a bad name when it comes to dealing with this, but it comes back to the point that I think it was Jacob made earlier, that if we're doing the same things the same way all the time, and I think I alluded to earlier about the ethnic groups, for example, white British, what a broad group, how useful is that as practitioners? Yeah. It's not really. The important thing with data, and hopefully where we can give it a good name in time to come when looking at the big picture, is data should be used to tell a story in a simple way without oversimplifying what you're trying to describe. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done across the education sector about data literacy, so people actually understand what are the limitations of what this information can tell me? What does this actually mean? What is it saying? What is it not saying? And I think we're probably going to come on to talk about technology later on as well. I know that was alluded to. Actually, technology is quite amazing, and there are things called influencer analyses. There are really powerful algorithms that now can operate, and they can pull in information from various different sources. Hundreds of different sources, and they can extrapolate and predict. But on the micro level, it doesn't work. And we saw that during COVID when the government tried to do the predicted outcomes, if you remember, back in 2020. And they said to each school, we can predict roughly what your kids are going to get based on how your school had done previously. You can do a pretty good prediction on school level, but what you can't do is go within the English class and say, well, the child sits third seat on the right, they're going to get this grade. The information isn't that sophisticated, and that's why you have to have this balance between the micro and the macro in terms of information. But don't dismiss data just yet. It's got a powerful role to play.
I agree.
I'm really impressed with what you just said.
I agree. But as long as we focus on using data for new steps forward rather than, like we've always done, mm-hmm. judging and using data, how we all trying to pigeonhole.
And understanding the limitations of it as well. I'm saying, what question are we trying to answer, and have we answered that question?
Yeah. One of the key things is in regards to, we've heard about some of the challenges, we've heard about also some of the positives and strengths of potentially the community, but how, and you just mentioned this, Dave, but how can we then start thinking about the role that technology can play in facilitating exchange and collaboration between, whether that's culturally or whether just in terms of education communities within one organisation, across breaking out the silos of working across trust, working across lines in regards to counties and cities and everything else. For those people who are still listening thinking that technology was created during COVID, it wasn't. It's like AI has only existed for the last 2 years. It hasn't. These are things that have existed for a long period of time. But if you think about a couple of statements that people have made of, well, some people working as parents want to be involved in the school, but they can't because they are working three jobs. And some people want to be involved in terms of adding strength to a governing body, or maybe want to be involved in the community of the school, but maybe no longer live in a demographic. So it's taken us, what, 5.5 hours to get down today, Ben? To be face-to-face is always not the easiest thing. But how can we leverage some of those technologies? How would we do that with synchronous and asynchronous? Just to define that of how can always everybody be present at the same time or doing something like we are now or on a Teams or a Google Meet, doing things all together? Or do we do that asynchronously so people can chip in and contribute their opinion and trying to break up some of those barriers and collaborate in a very different way than how we've done it?
I think there's, before we even get to that point, there's a deficit that needs to be filled in order for technology to be a benefit for everyone. I think, you know, we talk about how accessible it is to have a Teams meeting where everyone's not in the same place. It's great if you're quite used to being able to multitask and also you're in environments where you can do that. We've seen that during the pandemic where young people were working from home and then their younger sibling is running mayhem in the house. Or, you know, a parent doesn't know that something's happening and then the young person gets in trouble. It's so many issues there. I think for me, really, like, we talk about the simple parts of engagement, having a laptop, having accessible technology, having a good Wi-Fi connection. Mm-hmm. And then we think about literacy. And we talk about tech literacy is something that is a big issue. Mm. We talk about young people struggling to engage with tech other than their phones. Parents and generational issues there is something that we don't talk a lot about. I think to be solution focused, we should be thinking about education outside of the school system for the community, parents, wider people, as well as young people. So and it takes a lot of resource, and I think that's the thing. The money is geared at providing outcomes for our children, but where's the money to provide that supportive outcomes for the family, the community support, that young person? So as much as, if you think about a young person who needs intervention, and you think about the school providing that, what happens after they go home? You know, you can be the best teacher, and I've had some great people in school who's educated me, but I guess my success has come from the people outside of school. So I'll be much more interested to consider, how does the school use its resources, its teaching resources, for the community to bring them along that journey? So if we're saying we're going to have governor's meeting that's going to be hybrid, mm-hmm. can we first have an in-person meeting, and can we think about those people who want to become school governors, mm-hmm. for example, having a creche at the same time? So if you're a parent with a child, you can come and get along as well. And what language we use, because we make this assumption that everybody understands. And I mentioned about definitions of words, but I also mean in terms of what is the cultural norms, because in Lewisham, where I live, you have a big middle class group of people, and it doesn't necessarily mean economically they have money, mm-hmm. but what they partake in, what they engage in on a weekend, the things that they like doing, like Horniman Museum mm-hmm. is a free museum. If you go there, is mainly white middle class people that use the museum, but it's accessible to everyone. So why is it that one group of people feel like that's their safe space and accessible space to educate their kids outside of education, but black working class or other global majority heritage people don't feel like they are included in that space? I think those are the nuances we should talk more about. Because when you state the obvious, sometimes that's the solution, because you're admitting that I am different from you, and because we've got that elephant in the room exposed, we can kind of appreciate what makes us similar.
Interestingly, in that space as well, is that we've talked heavily around class, and actually we were interviewing two people who've written a book called The Working Classroom. This afternoon we're interviewing two people who have written that book, and the conversation is based on that idea that we don't talk about class in the UK anymore. Mm. And particularly in education, there's a huge issue when it comes to class. I think technology does create, if we're not careful, creates a bigger divide than ever before because of access to that and equitable access to that. But also, like you said about skill level, you talked about parental engagement. There's a huge issue between parental use of technology and ability to use technology, and then to be able to, then the gap gets even bigger, because if the children don't have access to the technology and the parents can't use it as well when they do get access to it, it just exacerbates the inequities. So I think from a technology perspective, there must be ways for us to, I suppose, even things like, one of the things that was jumping to my mind, I don't know if anybody else was thinking there, was things like live translation into various languages that we're moving into that space, whether that will help for an accessibility perspective, whether we should be doing things that aren't just literacy based, or like here's a, I'm chair of governors at a primary school, so when I go to a governor's meeting, or 27 governor's meetings a year, it feels like every committee I'm on, there's a 27 page document you need to read beforehand.
Yeah.
Well, if you've got an issue with your own literacy skills, there's a challenge that sits there. So how do we do that technologically? Do we help people with immersive reading stuff? Steve?
Well, I mean, I was kind of, so the approach that we've kind of gone down so far is like, no more snow days. Every time it snows, you can work from home on Teams now, so you're not losing that time. But I mean, from the angle I look at it, actually, I don't necessarily look at on the learning side of it, but I look on the teaching side of it. And teachers are at their best when they're actually teaching, and great teachers change lives. I think we all agree with that. But so what can we do? How can we use technology to make teaching easier for those teachers in terms of reducing their workload, in terms of quickly identifying children who are falling behind, in terms of identifying if there's interventions we've touched on earlier, what actually works, you know, and I'm thinking of like attendance interventions, for example. Kids need to be in school to be learning. What is the best way that we can improve attendance using research, looking at what interventions we've tried, what's worked, what hasn't worked? Are there particular communities that it's worked better in than others? And I think technology has a massive role to play on that side of things, but I appreciate that's from a different angle. It's not so much from the learning angle, it's more from how can we improve the effectiveness of our teaching and get more bang for the buck, effectively.
Do you know what the it's not just, it is about working class and not working class, but it also isn't about working class and not working class. It's about money. Let's be honest, if you're a single parent and actually you've got three children, and you only have one device, and the only device you've got is your phone, I think, unfortunately, the actual fallout of COVID, part of it was that there was a decision that was made that everyone can manage at home. I didn't manage. I was teaching at home at the same time my son was doing his work at home on his laptop. It was a complete nightmare. My living room was half decorated. I had to put a curtain up in order to do my videoing. I've got four children. My oldest daughter is actually 30 and she has a son. Her son is 3 and my other daughter has a 7-year-old and a 3-year-old, a 7-year-old. The one with the 7-year-old does go to one of our schools, one of the primary schools in New Cross. She has struggled with technology. I had to buy her a laptop when COVID hit, so that he could have access to the workload. The biggest issues I am having when I'm doing my work as a deputy Senko is the amount of phone calls I'm getting from parents who are now actually crying because they have no idea how to support with homework that is online. Now, homework online sounds like a really amazing idea. The things they are struggling with is it doesn't always work for dyslexic students. It doesn't always work for ADHD students. You've got one laptop, and I remember the way my son's homework was being given out, was you have to keep moving between files. So you've got the PowerPoint there, then you need to move on to another thing where the questions are, and then you need to go back. You have ADHD or dyslexia, and you're already struggling with managing the actual load of something in front of you that's visual. Having to navigate across those kind of systems actually can make a person quite stressed.
I've been sat here for 40 minutes and my ADHD is going off. So I absolutely feel what you're saying there. But you're absolutely right. From a technology perspective, we've tried to have that conversation around how technology can help with that community space, but we also acknowledge that it isn't the panacea. I think every one of us who has had the privilege of having technology in our hands, playing around with it now, would say that we want everybody to have an equitable access to that. But the reality is that technology is not the answer. It is part of an answer, potentially. And I think as we kind of thinking around more broadly, and this ties really nicely into this idea about reform, and technology's got to be part of that reform, is that the system that we're part of in England, I often say in the UK, but I don't think it's true, because Scotland has got a very, very different educational system, as has Wales. England is... unique. Unique is the word I like to use.
I call it how I see it.
No, no, I do usually.
That's part of our problem. I wouldn't say that I'm being pessimistic about it, but when you look at the outcomes, if you look at the young people, if you look at our community, the people who enter our community as adults, they're judged a certain way and they behave a certain way. At some point, where do we take responsibility? I come from a big family and my sister is very different from me. We have the same parents. Do I look at my mom and say she's a failure, or do I say, actually, at some point, you have to choose this and that will make a difference in terms of how your life is? I think you talk about technology, I feel like social media is a part of that learning space that we can be thinking about. You know, we talk often that kids in China, what they see on TikTok is very different to young people in the UK, or at least in other Western parts of the world.
Yeah.
Is that on purpose? One would argue. And
I think,
and I think, you know, my nieces, one thing I didn't mind them watching online is Gracie's Corner. And if you've got young people
that
watch it, yeah.
Love that.
It got a beat to it, and they're learning their alphabet, they're learning their numbers, is really interesting. I don't mind that. But for me, it's like, it's entertaining. If you think about young people who might have attention deficits, it helps them to pay attention to it. Now, my question would be, how does a teacher bring that into the classroom and use that as a medium to engage?
Yeah.
Because we talk about culture. If you're from what you might say a normal British middle class background or working class, whatever it might be, what your teacher is has an effect on how you're educated.
For sure.
So if we talk about seeing yourself, it doesn't necessarily mean you will connect. Because Emily, you mentioned before, coming from a Ghanaian background, one of the things that's really interesting in Lewisham, because I read the census data, I think you might love Steve. So I read it, and then what we found in Lewisham, if you're in the southern part of the borough, as a black person, you are from a Caribbean background. If you're from the north of the borough, you're more likely to be a West African background. Now, if you like food like I love food, the shops reflect the area, and what you can buy reflect in those areas. And now, if you're thinking about your teachers, where they come from, where they live, how they show up in school in terms of what, the interpersonal communication that they have, has a big difference whether I'm going to get, they don't say B's, is it nines and ones and twos? It makes a difference, right? So I think for me, really, the key part in terms of everything that we're talking about is the education for our staff. So like today, what we're doing today, the fact that staff are being able to come together and discuss these issues is really important. And I feel like if you put as much emphasis and energy into supporting your staff, engaging with your staff, having it those conversations, being able to breathe, like how you're working in a school, but to hear that you're volunteering at the Migration Museum, which I love as well, that's great. But we only just got the Migration Museum.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah.
I think you're right. And interestingly, from that space around... we've got 300 episodes online. you won't be surprised to hear that we don't use words like unique usually. We would usually use the word backwards about the education system. Okay, so we know that there is a work to be done in terms of our system, because there's a third of our students leave and aren't ready to go into the workplace, at least if we're saying that the measure is maths and English. We know we are failing a third of our student young people in the UK. That is not acceptable. Like, and we've got the amount of people that don't go to university who want to go to university, the huge class differences, financial differences, attainment differences, there's just something that's just not quite right.
And SEN differences when it comes to school refusals.
Yeah,
attendance
elements around that. And so we're going to bring the podcast towards a close, because actually we've been going for nearly 45 minutes, which is surprising.
It feels like 15.
So we always finish our podcasts in this most recent season with some quickfire questions. And those quickfire questions are based on the idea that the key word is quick. I say that, but every single one that we've done so far has not. Steve just carries on talking through it. So the idea is a quickfire question with a quickfire answer. And so it's from the gut of who you are. And what we'll do is we'll go anti-clockwise. If that's all right this time with the questions.
No, let's stick to it.
Let's
stick to it.
Steve don't like change. We won't mention any of that.
Let's not mention ability to change in that regard. But let's stick to
Okay,
clockwise.
So we're
going
to go to Emily first.
Yes.
Go on then, Tim.
Okay. Future of exams, online, traditional, scrapped?
Traditional.
Okay.
Traditional, I agree. I think,
can I expand?
Traditional. I can't expand, right. You go. Your view is much more relevant than mine.
I would just say traditional just because you have to, regardless what job or whatever the future is, it's a skill that children should all experience at some point in their life.
The only skill?
Not the only skill, but it's a skill that they should, which will prepare them.
And my yes is because two things. Firstly, I sat in a classroom like this 50 years ago and people would have talked about exams and whether they're any good, and they're still in remarkably the same. They're called GCSEs now. They used to be called O-levels, but they're very, very similar. So we always overestimate the degree of change, I think. Yeah.
Not sure what they're called in 1872. Well, let's move on. Steve?
Traditional, but in a hybrid format.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I agree with that. Traditional, but in a hybrid format.
I would say traditional and scrapped at the same time. Mm. There's certain exams I've taken, no one's never asked me, and I'm only 30. Did you take that exam? It has no effect on my day-to-day job, besides obviously the basics. So I think keep the traditional basics, but there's other things that could be scrapped. Waste too much time.
Love it. Okay. I so want to speak at this, but it's quick fire. So, key skill for students in 2040. So 15, 16 years from now, the key skill for students in 2040. Emily.
A key skill for them to be able to read.
Okay.
Can I introduce one which I think is creativity? So I'm involved with a fantastic youth charity called Envision, and it's one of the things that they emphasise. And one of the reasons they emphasise it is because in a world where technology plays an increasingly important role, if you don't have the ability to think creatively, you're not going to be able to influence your own future. So I think it's not talked about enough, but I think it's something I'd love to see schools teaching more, and you can teach it. You can teach people how to develop that skill. I've got no doubt about that.
Thank you.
Quick fire, remember.
Critical thinking, I think that might make a comeback and become big in the future. Understanding how things work.
Resilience. Think it trumps everything. Not going to do a quick fire one. Sorry.
These are our podcast, right? They're our rules. If you don't like the rules, don't play again.
And that's why school doesn't work.
I like having the opportunity to speak, and I'm going to just very quickly say, my thing at school was I actually left with one O-level. I was not well behaved at school. There was various different reasons for that. If I hadn't at some point later on in my life developed resilience, I would not be sitting here now.
That's an okay. No.
It was a quick one, wasn't
quickish.
It? Quickish.
Quickish fire questions. That's
what slowing it down. Come on.
For me, interpersonal skills, I think, especially what Steve said and others as well, it's really important.
Yeah.
We need that human connection to be a lot more clearer for each other.
Okay, last question. Education in 50 years, what is your vision?
My goodness.
You're acting a head teacher, by the way.
Exactly.
I'm just saying.
Like,
it's okay. It doesn't have to be speaking from the school.
In 50 years, I don't think that there'll be schools. I think we're moving with the whole AI. I think we talk about resilience, interpersonal skills. I'm thinking it's moving in a direction where you may not actually physically need children to actually be in the school building.
Oh, great, we're going to have some disagreement here.
Positive disagreement.
No, only because I was the last year to do maths when you had a slide rule. And so I was educated before computers and so on. And the thing that strikes me is how similar the environment is to the one that I knew. So I think it will change. My prediction is it will change less than you think. But also the changes will be driven by technology, which none of us understand what will be here. So I think the most important thing in that environment is to teach the core values that we've been talking about today, to equip children to deal with whatever future they may face.
Well, I hope they've made some decision on 16 to 19 education by 2050, because we wait a long time for that. I think paper will still be here. I think we'll still have class formats of people together. Mm-hmm. Maybe when people are being taught are different. There's a lot of research that looks at when different people learn best, but quickfire. So I think, yeah.
Yeah, I think I've got to quite a ripe old age where my whole experience at school is pretty similar to the experience of children going to school now. So I feel like in 50 years' time, we'll still have... Do you know what it is and it isn't? The thing that's changed is the onus on mental health in schools. That's been the biggest change.
I think school in 50 years, I think, as was mentioned before, things are going to go really backwards. I don't want to be pessimistic about it, but I think it's going to go back to the point where your young people get into the schools that they are can afford to get into. And it's going to be a lot more separation and more, I don't want to say classes because I don't want to sound like I'm just all about class, but I do think if we think about other countries that are big in technology, for example, they're going to be way ahead of the game. So there's really going to be a lot more groupthink and individuality rather than something, you know, life-changing that it should be for education.
Yeah, I think I sat my GCSEs in...
1975.
1983, so I, 1995, secondary school to 2000, a lot hasn't changed. My worry is I really struggled with school. Didn't conform. Didn't enjoy it. Was taught in a way really didn't. I probably spent quite a bit of time out in my GCSE years because of just my focus on education. Let's put it down as that, and how that has influenced potentially how I want to try and drive change. We talked about England. I think one of the biggest changes that we'll see, and we've been involved in a lot of these programs where you've got some online schools that will cascade across internationally, globally, that will really start to influence whether where learners want to do, how they want to learn, the access to it and the type of learning that is available in their local area that isn't just the school, which is their local school. And I think that's probably the biggest disruptor that I foresee. I think it's exciting. I'm not going to put my vision in because we'll probably do it every episode. I'm going to be like Ben Rapp.
In terms of 50 years, also it depends on the government. It also depends on even education, how, you know, if you're doing your degree in education, like the courses, all of that's going to change. So I think that will have a huge impact. So you say about your GCSEs, and I think back, when I did my GCSEs, 1995, 96, I'm not sure, then. So in terms of that, things will change. But also, if you look at teachers as well, how much they're changing, I think that will also move, that will steer the direction of schools in 50 years.
And I don't know why I said that school hasn't changed.
That's what I'm
like, we're still going to a classroom, we still sit down, and I know we're doing this really quickly, but I'm going to say one last thing, and that is that as part of my teacher training course, I got to go to Baltimore, the actual university paid for it, and look in schools in Baltimore, which were mainly black schools, and we've spent the whole week in different schools. The most amazing place I visited was Morgan State University, that actually has, in terms of inclusion, they have a whole, way bigger than this room, a gallery, which has historic African pieces and contemporary black art. And the way that the students interacted with it was incredible. And the research that they are putting in still into looking at black boys and the reading and how do we progress students and how do we actually work with parents. And one of the other primary schools, which I thought was incredible, was they knew that that particular school was in a really poor area. All of the students had a free breakfast club, and what they did was they did catch up times tables with them whilst they were doing the breakfast club. And positivity in terms of all the displays were just incredibly positive. And I imagine that just makes quite a difference.
For sure. Well, it's been fascinating. We could have probably gone on for another 45 minutes, if not longer. Steve usually says that. He usually says, we're going to talk till night. It's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you to all five of you for your input and for helping us develop this idea about together, stronger community culture. This haberdashery. Haberdashers, Multi-Academy Trust, PD Day. Now, down in the lovely south of England, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having us. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.